Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the studios of our New York affiliate, WWRL. So pleased to be here with you all. Rennie Bishop running the station and running pretty much everything right now. Just doing a great job. Thank you, Rennie. And it is yesterday and today, the rollout of Air America 2.0, the relaunch of Air America. In these 2 days, we're doing something unique. We'll be back to kind of normal programming tomorrow with a series of interviews with folks wishing us well and bringing them into Air America 2.0. And the first one for today is Ralph Nader. On the line with us, Ralph Nader, the star of An Unreasonable Man, the new documentary, his newest book, The 17 Traditions, and, of course, in my opinion, a great American hero, man I voted for once for president and didn't once. We've had that discussion before. And a man who has transformed the landscape of America, I think, vastly for the better. Ralph Nader, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
So glad to have you with us. One of the things that you've been talking about recently is Mike Gravel's National Initiative for Democracy. Do you mind getting into this a little bit?
Yes, I mean, that is a remarkable position he's taken, and he's thought about it for years in consultation with some of the nation's leading constitutional law professors. And what he's asserting is that the people in this country are really constitutionally authorized, rooted in the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and statements in the Federalist Papers, to write their own laws. What was lacking is procedures for implementing this direct democracy national initiative authority. And he has proposed a several thousand word proposal to see that the discussion during the presidential campaign is on such fundamentals and not simply on slogans and pontifications and promises meant to be broken. I've never seen or read about a presidential candidate from the major parties offer such a fundamental change in our constitutional system in terms of the power of the people.
Yeah, and I've read it, and I've read your writings on it, and I've interviewed Mike Gravel about once a year for the last 5 years. He's been on our radio program. And here's my concern. First of all, to take this from the abstract to the practical, for our listeners who may not know exactly what we're talking about here, in 20-some-odd states, I think it's 21 states, have a system on the books, laws on the books, that allow individual citizens, if they can hit a certain threshold number of petitions, petition signatures, to put something on the ballot to become law, to amend the constitution of a state or to become a law for the state. And, for example, probably the most famous is Prop 13 in California that froze property taxes years ago. And then many other states, the majority of the other states in the United States, don't have that, and the only way that a law can be passed is through the legislature. And what this is essentially suggesting is that at a national level, we all be able to participate in an initiative process. That is, if a certain minimum threshold of people can get something on a national ballot, that it show up during the national elections, and we can all become legislators. Do I have it right?
Not quite. Unlike the state referendum or initiative authorities, the state legislatures have a lot of restrictive controls, and they can, for example, repeal what the people vote for, or they can make the initiative process run through hoops, or make the number of signatures very onerous. What Mike Gravel is proposing is a national initiative authority that the Congress cannot touch. And it's an authority that doesn't qualify for the ballot. It either wins a majority of registered voters or it doesn't. So it's not a two-step process. Mm-hmm. And finally, what's most important about it is that the arguments you can make against it. Well, you know, there'll be a proposal and the companies will load the media and distort it. Well, if the people have the national initiative, Tom, they can change the media. They can open up public media. They can change the problems and turn them into solutions. So much more fundamental than the state initiatives that you referred to.
But for example, I live in Oregon right now, which is a state which has an initiative process.
Mm.
And we have seen a series of right-wing crackpot initiatives that have been passed as a result of what I would call pretty straightforward misleading advertising. And it wasn't funded by big corporations. In one case, it was funded by a guy who lives in Las Vegas who describes himself as a sexual hypnotist. And in another case, by a real estate billionaire from Chicago. Basically conservative activists who are trying these things out in smaller states and then, you know, when they're successful, rolling them out to larger states. And so how, with a national program like this, do you keep somebody like, you know, one of the Walton heirs who have more money than God from influencing this?
You have a national initiative that prevents private funding of national initiatives. They can be funded by a public trust fund. That can be funded in turn by a tax on speculation in the stock markets or a tax on pollution. And it can require equal time access to the mass media. That's what I mean about the national initiative that Mike Gravel is proposing. Now, you can list one objection after another, but the initiative can override that objection and plant the power of the people further and firmer in direct democracy. Also, there's a civic maturation aspect to it. As more people understand and participate in writing these laws, you have a much more deliberative democracy, much more discussion and debate. It affects the candidates for electoral office at all levels of government. And it's the way to go. Obviously, we have seen some pretty bad decisions made by representative government in state capitals, city councils, and the national legislature.
Right.
The war in Iraq, for example, would never have occurred if we had a national initiative process. We would never have this inequitable tax system where the rich get away with it and the corporations can go to the Bahamas if there is a national initiative. And the national initiative would also be authorized to amend the Constitution.
So, one of the biggest objections to this typically is the First Amendment. You know, you can't limit the spending of, for example, you know, the rich guy in Chicago, the real estate billionaire who wants to influence the initiative process here in Oregon. You can't do that because, you know, arguably you could with a corporation, although corporations argue that they're persons, but that's a whole other discussion. But with an individual, I mean, yes, that's an individual, and the Supreme Court has ruled that the First Amendment prohibition against restrictions on free speech is particularly important when it comes to political free speech. And you're suggesting that, for example, we could amend the Constitution to say that laws like they have in the United Kingdom, where you can't give more than a political candidate can't spend more than £100,000 when they're running for Parliament, period, regardless of the source. And therefore,
or there could be a national initiative that says all public elections shall be funded with public money, just like public parks funded by public money, public mm-hmm. schools by public money, and no private money is permitted. And there could also be part of the amendment to prohibit corporations who are not real people, the entity I'm talking about, the corporate entity, from participating in politics or lobbying in any shape whatsoever.
Right. But how do you get around the Supreme Court and the First Amendment?
Because you amend the Constitution. That overrides the Supreme Court decision that money is speech.
But the amendment process for the Constitution is spelled out in the Constitution, and it doesn't include the national initiative.
Yeah, but the national initiative can change the amendment process to provide a role for the national initiative in amending the Constitution.
So this can be done without a constitutional convention, in other words.
Well, they can change the Constitution in that manner. Basically, it's the sovereignty of the people being reduced to a printed proposal and put out there on the presidential campaigns for next year for discussion and debate among the people, whether it's in their living rooms or in taverns or in general stores or parks or town meetings or whatever. I mean, the point is to have a discussion about it.
Yeah. Well, I think it's fascinating. And you know, one of the things that I always find fascinating about you, Ralph Nader, is that you're you're a guy who lives with ideas. You love ideas. You've developed some of the most potent ideas in our time, and you know, been in many ways a powerful truth teller for all of us. I'm curious what other things are catching your fancy right now. What are the, in the political landscape, what are the things that you're finding fascinating?
Well, it's the corporate hijacking of our government. You see, the principle representative government by our founding fathers was based on an understanding that once Thomas Jefferson articulated when he says the principle of representative government is to, quote, counteract the excesses of the moneyed interests, end quote. So the moneyed interests today are the corporate interests. And so we don't have a representative government as was foreseen over 200 years ago. We have a corporate government. We have a corporate government that has hijacked our national government in the service of corporate profits and corporate policies and corporate executive compensation and corporate command of agencies, departments, and our electoral process. So we have a real crisis here, and that's why we've got to go back to the only source of sovereignty that is something that we treasure in our country. And most people talk about the sovereignty of the people. Are those just mealy-mouthed words, or do they have a constitutional basis, as well as in the first juridical document of our country, which is the Declaration of Independence?
Yeah, I think you'll agree with me, though, that Mike Gravel's suggestion, the National Initiative for Democracy, is a real long shot. Do you have any other thoughts on ways that this might be accomplished?
Well, it won't be accomplished unless people want it. I mean, that's the beauty of his proposal. Nobody's going to impose a national initiative on the people of the United States. The corporations don't want it. The politicians don't want it. So if it does occur, it's because enough people have said our country's going in the wrong direction, seriously. 71% in the latest poll believe that. The promise of our country is not being paralleled with its performance. Our national standards of living are being degraded with these globalized corporate trade agreements, pull-down agreements, and on and on. And that's what's so wonderful about this proposal. It cannot be instituted without the majority support of the voters in this country.
And what about, for example, the movement to end corporate personhood, to strip corporations of the, you know, they claim that this 1886 Supreme Court decision gave corporations the rights of persons under the 14th Amendment. It didn't, in fact, although the headnote says that it did. And the court has quoted that headnote now 37 times, I think. There's quite a growing movement across the United States to, and a number of, over 100 communities now in Pennsylvania from CELDEF's work, to stop the right of persons to going to corporations.
Yeah, well, it's a mess we've gotten ourselves into. I mean, the only people who should be able to lobby are real people. The only people who should be able to engage in electioneering are real people. The only people who make decisions in this country should be real people, not an artificial entity called a multinational corporation or corporations. And the idea of having equal justice under the law between you and General Motors or you and Exxon or you and Citibank is absurd. How can we give these corporations, as we have, all the constitutional rights that we have, except for the Fifth Amendment right of self-incrimination? They have all the constitutional rights we have. And they have all the privileges and immunities to concentrate power and technology and political influence that none of us as individual human beings could ever amass and expect to live in a society of equal justice under law. Would we give constitutional rights to robots? Let's say you had a robot that actually produced products and sold products. It was all computerized. Would we say to that robot, you can have great influence over Congress, you can give all kinds of money through your robotic arms to senators and representatives and presidential candidates, and you can have a say as to whether we go to war or not, how little you're being taxed compared to working people, on and on? Of course we wouldn't. So,
but we have.
Yeah, but yeah, we have to the corporate entity.
Right.
That's right. And that's, but if it was a robot, in other words, if it looked a little robotic like us, we would say, this is crazy.
Yeah.
But instead, it's an abstract, it's a legal abstraction called the corporate entity, which is, created not by investors. Investors do not create corporations. They just fund them. The corporations chartered mostly by state governments and in the banking area and some other areas by the federal government. So corporations are creatures of our government, and that charter can be conditioned in any way, shape, and manner to make sure that corporations, which once were chartered in the early 19th century in Massachusetts to be our servants, and they're now our masters, revert back to the original concept, which is the corporations to be our servant, not our master. And nobody knows more about this than you, Tom, because you've written books and articles about it.
And you've been working on this your entire life. It's something close to both of us. Ralph Nader, consumer advocate, lawyer, author of most recently The 17 Traditions, star of the movie, the documentary An Unreasonable Man. Ralph Nader, thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, and I hope you'll read the 17 Traditions, especially young families, because it's about how my mother and father raised their four children in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And it's just full of wisdom and insight, humor, and advice that's very relevant to families today trying to figure out how to control things around them better than they are at the present time.
Yeah, something we very much need. Ralph Nader, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back.
The Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
That's right. It's one of my favorite songs from back home. Home on the range. Oh, give me a home where no liberals roam and the folks all think the same way.
And welcome back. Well, you know, I can still respect Ralph Nader, even though I told him on the air, actually, during the 2004 election. I thought he was making a huge mistake running for president again, but anyhow, that's a whole other issue. Hey, I've got to tell you, George W. Bush has plans to take over this country real soon, and it's real scary. I'll tell you about it right after the news, but right after the break of 5 o'clock.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Here's something nobody's hearing. May 9th, 2007. You can find this over at the WhiteHouse.gov website. While you're on the way, check out WhiteHouse.org. It's always good for a smile. But in any case, the WhiteHouse.gov website, the official White House website. On May 9th, there is a press release under the banner of the White House President George W. Bush. For immediate release, Office of the Press Secretary, etc., National Security Presidential Directives. There's two of them, NSPD 51 and NSPD 20. What these two National Security Presidential Directives do, along with the classified attachments to them, which are not spelled out, as it were. I mean, you know, you won't find those. You'll find they're called classified continuity annexes, and you'll find reference to them in the presidential directive. But the directive itself is scary enough. What this does is it says that if there is another Katrina, for example, or another 9/11, for example, or a major earthquake in California, or actually could even be a bad computer virus attacks the economic infrastructure of the United States, see, it's entirely up to the president to decide when, you know, what the trigger is. That if that happens, the president takes over control of the country. And Congress and the court systems no longer have a say in what's going on. Now, that's not the exact language of it, but if you read the language of it, it's some pretty startling stuff, isn't it? First of all, here's the definition. The purpose of this directive establishes a comprehensive national policy on the continuity of federal government, right? In other words, you know, if there's a problem, we have to make sure the government continues operating. Now, in its most extreme fashion, you could argue that, hey, what if there was a 9/11 type strike on Washington, D.C., and, you know, took out everybody in Congress and the president, the vice president, everybody else? You know, what happens? Well, actually, there are already directives and laws and rules in place about that sort of thing. This is that on steroids. This says, for example, definitions in this directive. Catastrophic emergency means any incident, regardless of location. You get it? So they're not talking about what if Washington, D.C. gets taken out and all our lawmakers die. This could happen in Butte, Montana. And the president could say, ah, that's it. It's a national emergency. Any incident, regardless of location, that results in extraordinary levels of mass casualties, damage, or disruption severely affecting the U.S. population, infrastructure, environment, economy, or government functions. So it doesn't have to be mass casualties. It doesn't even have to be mass damage. It could just be disruption of our economy. Or of our environment. Hey, we've got an oil spill off the coast of California. I'm reading from the actual document, from the actual White House website. Enduring Constitutional Government, or ECG, means a cooperative effort among the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of the federal government. Okay, so far sounds good, right? Coordinated effort, three branches of government. Coordinated by the president. As a matter of comity with respect to the legislative and judicial branches and with proper respect for the constitutional separation of powers among the branches. Now, as a matter of comity, in other words, he will in a friendly fashion, in a congenial fashion, he will acknowledge the existence of the legislative and judicial branches, but it will be coordinated by the president. Those four words are the key to this entire thing. To this May 9th, 2007 National Security Presidential Directive signed by George W. Bush. This is now, without the function of the legislature, this is now part of the law of the land. This will, now, implementation actions. These are the things that will be done under this. A, ensuring the continued functioning of our term of government under the Constitution, including the functioning of the three separate branches of government. Sounds good. Providing leadership visible to the nation and the world and maintaining the trust and confidence of the American people. Yes, that's what we're going to depend upon the president to do. Excuse me, I think that many of us would be much more comfortable if rather than everything in the government being coordinated by the president, if we left intact our Constitution, thank you very much, I think that might inspire the trust and confidence of the American people in the world a little better than this. C, defending the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and preventing or interdicting attacks against the United States or its people, property, or interests. In other words, the president can now do anything he damn well pleases. D, maintaining and fostering effective relations with foreign nations. We don't need no stinking war resolutions from Congress. E, protecting, that was from me, not from the news release, back to the news release. E, protecting against threats to the homeland and bringing to justice perpetrators of crimes or attacks against the United States or its people, property, or interests. You get at this, the conservative worldview that I am continually talking about on this program, of the function of government is to punish. The function of government is to be muscular and strong, and unless it has to do with, you know, helping folks out. No. It is so embodied in this. And then it goes on. These are the implementation actions, okay? Item 6. The president shall lead the activities of the federal government for ensuring constitutional government. In order to advise and assist the president in that function, the assistant to the president for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism, APHS/CT, is hereby designated as the National Continuity Coordinator. So now we have, under the president, a de facto U.S. czar. That person, the Security Affairs, APNSA, without exercising directive authority, shall coordinate and the development and implementation of continuity policy for executive departments and agencies, and should be the main forum, the main day-to-day forum for such policy coordination. This national continuity coordinator is to put together a plan for how everything is supposed to go. It shall be submitted to the president for approval not later than 90 days after the date of this directive. Okay, so you have a disaster. The president takes over. He's the absolute ruler of the country for 90 days until he gets a plan. And then if he likes the plan, he decides whether or not he's going to continue to be the ruler. Or maybe the plan says, like Cheney did, hey, you know, I'm supposed to look for a vice president for you. How about me? I'll be the vice president. Item 11, paragraph A, the continuity of the performance of the PMEFs during any emergency must be for a period of up to 30 days or until normal operations can be resumed. So what is normal? I mean, Bush is still saying that we're in a state of war as a result of 9/11. And yet the guys who did 9/11 presumably died in it. Sheikh Khalid Mohammed, the guy who, according to the Bush administration, was the mastermind, is in our custody and is being tried for that. The major funder of it, Osama bin Laden, well, he's hiding out, but does that mean that we're still in a state of panic and terror as a consequence of that? I mean, this is absolutely incredible. It's in order to provide a coordinated response to escalating threats of action or actual emergencies, the continuity of government readiness conditions system establishes executive branch coordinating continuity program readiness levels, focusing on possible threats to the national capital region. The president will determine and use the COGCON level. Executive departments and agencies shall come. He will determine and issue the COGCON level. In other words, and the president now will say, okay, we're at red, we're at orange, we're at yuck, whatever, except that this isn't a colored system. He gets to decide how much of an emergency we're at, how many rights we have, how much power is going to be taken by the president. Executive departments and agencies, again, reading from paragraph 12, executive departments and agencies shall comply with the requirements and assigned responsibilities under the COGCON program. In other words, everybody who works in the executive branch of government, which is like the Department of Justice and the FBI and the CIA and the NSA and the Department of Defense and all those, I mean, all the regulatory agencies as well, all those that are charged by and large with putting into place and following through on and executing the laws that are established by Congress, except now they'll be established by this new super executive, they all fall under his absolute control, as opposed to presumably the rule of law. Then it goes on to talk about the Secretary of Homeland Security. We're talking in this case right now about Michael Chertoff, a guy who holds citizenship in two different nations, and who was the head of FEMA and did a marvelous job during Hurricane Katrina. All right, Secretary of Homeland Security shall coordinate. Well, as Secretary of Homeland Security, he was head of FEMA, shall we say. The Secretary of Homeland Security shall coordinate the implementation, execution, and assignment of continuity operations and activities. He gets to run the show. So we have Mr. Chertoff, Mr. Skeletor, and Francis Fragos Townsend, who is the National Continuity Coordinator, is going to, quote, give guidance to state, local, territorial, and tribal governments and private sector owners and operators of critical infrastructure. Maybe your gas station is critical infrastructure. Maybe your department store is critical infrastructure. Who knows? Maybe your home is. Strange stuff. You got to check this out. NSPD 51, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
far as I can tell, this National Security Presidential Directive, NSPD 51, and the one associated with HSPD 20, have only been really talked about in any way by an article by Matthew Rothschild in the Progressive magazine, progressive.org online. It was reprinted over at truthout.org, and I'm guessing other sites are starting to pick it up. I mean, this is truly remarkable. And George W. Bush being able to declare himself emperor in the event of a national emergency. And this released May 9th. This is just a few weeks ago. It's a little spooky. Also, on March 9th, 2006, this is a year ago, Bush signed H.R. 3199. This renewed the Patriot Act. It also included in the Presidential Succession Act the Secretary of Homeland Security. So, are we looking at a fundamental realignment of American government? Certainly in the case of an emergency, it looks that way. Will in South Park, Colorado. Hey, Will, what's up?
Truth teller, how you doing, man?
I'm great, but I'm concerned.
I'm very concerned, as I've been since 98 when I started thinking this was kind of like a Nazi-like attempt at taking over America, man.
Yeah.
And it seems like that each and every day more so, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, in some ways, and that's why I think it's so important that we get out there and that we be talking to our elected representatives and we be talking about this in the news and in the media. I mean, it's just it's something that we absolutely have to be dealing with. We absolutely have to be dealing with. Julian in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Julian.
Hi, I'm out in a very traffic heavy zone. I don't know if you can hear me well or not right now.
Sure, it's fine.
Okay. Well, I was going to talk about Ralph Nader, but what the heck. Since you brought this up, I was wondering if maybe Cheney's April Fool's joke wasn't such a joke after all.
You mean the widely circulated, a lot of people bid on that, thinking that Cheney had essentially declared emperor power for himself.
And, right.
Yeah. Yeah. It appears now that Bush has actually done this. And I mean, when I first read this story in the Progressive by Matthew Rothschild, I thought, nah. So I went over to the White House website, and it's sitting right there, right? I mean, it's
right.
Like they're bragging about it. They're saying, here it is. You know, we're in charge now. And I'm like, wow, this is incredible. And you can read it, whitehouse.gov. It's the May 9th, 2007 press release. It's absolutely bizarre. Hey. Julian, thanks for the call. Lewis in Manhattan. Hey, Lewis.
Yes, good afternoon. Did you ever read the interpretation of John Marshall's interpretation of treason?
What's that?
Under the English law, he raised the bar so no one could ever be accused of treason without reaching the standard violating due process of law. This clearly violates due process of law. It's more than enough grounds for treason.
That's interesting.
But why is Congress being a co-conspirator with this administration?
I wonder if Congress even knows about this. By the way, Lewis, for our listeners who don't know who John Marshall is, and thanks for raising that and for pointing that out, John Marshall was Thomas Jefferson's cousin. They were bitter enemies. He was a Federalist, which would be a conservative Republican in today's parlance. Thomas Jefferson was the founder of the Democratic Republican Party, which we now call the Democratic Party. And as a parting shot, as John Adams, the second president, left office, having been defeated by Thomas Jefferson, our third president, in the election of 1800, as a parting shot against Jefferson, Adams installed Jefferson's cousin, who, as I said, Jefferson hated, as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Marshall. And Marshall was actually a fairly reasonable Supreme Court justice in some regards, although he and Jefferson continuously clashed, and he was on the court for, I think, either 24 or 34 years thereafter, I mean, a long time. And it was in 18, as I recall, 1803 or maybe 1807, in the Marbury versus Madison decision, that it was Chief Justice John Marshall who decided that the Supreme Court got to decide whether something was constitutional or not, because the Constitution doesn't actually say that. So he took, and Jefferson was totally flipped out by that. He says, with a single stroke of the pen, he says, the Constitution has become a thing of wax. He was totally freaked out. But that's interesting that Marshall said that treason is violation of due process. Yeah, well, in that case, then you could go back and say Bush was guilty. If that's the case, you could say Bush was guilty of treason when he broke the FISA laws. I mean, this is incredible. Jay in San Diego, California. Hey, Jay.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call. I wanted to talk a little bit about this White House report that you just mentioned about basically taking over the government in the
emergency. Yeah, it's not a report. It's an executive order.
Right, executive order.
You can
thank
read
you.
It right online.
I was going to suggest there is a group out there called continuityofgovernment.org,
mm-hmm.
and they have a report. They've been actually studying this, the very real possibility that we could have a major catastrophe and what to do because it really hasn't been codified. And also one of the people that's kind of he's on this within this commission and he's sort of an expert on these sorts of things is Norm Ornstein. He used to be on Al Franken show.
Right. Norm is in fact at the Continuity Government Commission's homepage, continuitygovernment.org, there's a picture of him along with Congressman Brian Barrett from Washington State.
Yes,
I talk with often.
Great if you could get him on your show and discuss this particular executive order and the dangers therein. I just scanned through it, and it's so vague. That's what's so dangerous about it.
Yes, the discretion about virtually everything is in the hands of George W. Bush. I mean, it's just amazing. Jay, thanks for the heads up. Charlie in Rochelle Park, New Jersey. Charlie got about a half a minute before we wrap up this hour.
Okay. Hi, Tom. I thought I'd check with you. I mean, what's happened with the militias now, those survivalist militias that were afraid the government was going to take away all our freedom?
They're still out there. I mean, you know, they're still running. There's shortwave radio stations.
But we don't hear about them. I mean, are they part of the diminishing 27% or?
That's a good question.
Whether that
movement, as it were, is growing or shrinking, I frankly don't know. I know that I've been on some of their radio programs from time to time as a guest, you know, and it's very interesting because you get, you know, people who are really and truly concerned about the future of America, and yet, you know, the movement itself is contaminated with all sorts of, some very strange characters. But you know, they're out there, like, you know, well, I got my guns and I got a year's worth of food, and when the government goes down, I'm going to take over. But some of them are dead serious. And this will probably give more food for paranoia, too. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. The Senate Commerce Committee is going to be voting on a plan to increase what are called CAFE standards, corporate average fuel efficiency, and corporate meaning the auto industry, fuel standards right across the board for the auto industry, saying that you guys want to make cars, that's fine, but you're going to have to make them in a way that is going to be actually positive, not a net negative, shall we say, or a positive for the people of the United States, cars that are a little more fuel efficient, cars that don't put as much carbon into the atmosphere. Sam Kasman, the general counsel for the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and the author, I'm assuming, of this news release about it. You can find it over at CEI.org. suggesting that this is a risk to America. So, well, actually, I don't want to put words in your mouth, Sam. Welcome to the program.
Hi, good afternoon.
Your take on this?
Look, I think this fuel economy program, the CAFE program, is one of the worst regulatory programs on the books in terms of just what it's done in the several decades that we've had it. And what the Commerce Committee is planning to do, I'd say, is make it about three times as bad as it currently is, because the numbers they picked, and I think they really picked them out of thin air, are going to be very difficult to meet, and while some car makers will succeed, I think the real victims here are going to be consumers.
Sam, presumably because you're asserting the price of cars will go up?
Not just the price of cars. I think the quality of vehicles, in terms of what's available, in terms of their capacity, is just going to become incredibly downsized.
Downsized.
Sure. I mean, you know, if you want an example of what government efficiency regs have done, pick up the current issue of Consumer Reports, and it will tell you that top-loading washing machines have pretty much been destroyed by the Department of Energy regs for those. And frankly, if the government can destroy a simple appliance like a top-loading washer, what it can do to a more complex thing like cars, I think, is just unbelievable.
Well, when CAFE standards first came into place, it didn't destroy the auto industry. In fact, the auto industry became more profitable and more cars were being sold. I mean, basically, there are two. If we accept the premise, and maybe you don't even accept this premise, but if you accept the premise that our dependence upon foreign supplies of oil is putting our nation at risk, A, in other words, there's a national security issue here, and B, that all this carbon going into the atmosphere is not a good thing, you know, whether or not it's causing global warming or, you know, whatever. If you accept those two premises, and about between a third and a half, I believe, of the carbon-based fuels burned in the United States are burned in our cars, then there's only really two ways to reduce the amount of carbon that's going up into the atmosphere and the amount of oil that's being imported for the use of cars. One is to let the, quote, free market, end quote, take, you know, do its magic, as it were. Although in Europe, for example, the average car gets about twice the average fuel efficiency of one in the United States, in the Western European countries. That's because gasoline is $5, $6, $7, $8, $9 a gallon in European countries. Although that, again, is intervention by the government. Most of that's taxes. But, you know, so we could wait around for the oil companies to decide that you know, the next CEO, instead of taking a $400 million payout when he leaves, you know, is going to take a $1 trillion payout or something and jack the price of gasoline up to $10 or $12 a gallon. We could wait for that to happen, and then, of course, everybody will want to buy a more fuel-efficient car. But or we can simply, as we the people collectively through government, mandate that car manufacturers are going to make more fuel-efficient cars. What other options are there?
I mean, look, I don't think higher fuel economy is going to do anything when it comes to dependence on foreign oil. In fact, if anything, you know, to the extent those higher fuel regs succeed, what they do is they slightly drive down the world price of oil because they may somewhat reduce demand in the U.S. But what that means in turn is that domestic supplies of oil become even less competitive. American supplies of oil, you know, supplies within this country, are relatively high-cost producers. When you drive down the world price of oil, you're hurting American production, I'd say, more than anything else.
Well, if you're reducing the price of oil, yeah, anybody who's pumping oil out of the ground in the United States is not going to make quite as much profit, so the oil company's profits might diminish slightly, in theory. At least at the level of crude. But we're talking about gasoline here. Do you really think that the price of crude is tied to the price of gasoline?
Yeah, because I think, you know, it generally they follow each other pretty well. You know, you've got some seasonal blips, but those are very short term. But I think the real thing is, look, if you want to cut down on the amount of oil we use, or the amount of gasoline we use, the most politically honest way of doing it is to raise the gas tax. Now, I do not advocate doing that, but I'd say that is a much more honest way of doing it than with the...
But if you do that, what you're going to do is you're going to whack the middle class and you're going to whack working people.
Well, please,
and big deal, yeah. And,
once you have cars being produced under higher CAFE standards, you'll be whacking those very same
people. No, you won't.
The National Academy of Sciences back in 2002 had an exhaustive report on the CAFE standards to date. And what they found is the downsizing effect of CAFE, making vehicles smaller and lighter, probably accounts for about 2,000 deaths per year. Now, this is for a program we've had on the books for maybe 30, 40 years. You run the numbers, that's a huge toll in terms of deaths.
Compared to the potential for the, several million deaths per year that are associated with hydrocarbon pollution in our atmosphere of cancer primarily and lung disease?
That is a projection that I don't buy, but
burning fossil fuels doesn't affect the environment?
If you want to cut down CO2 emissions, there's only one way to do it, and it's not CAFE. It is to stop having children. Because anything you do in terms of reducing your carbon footprint by buying, say, a Prius, is going to be more than offset by what your kids do when they grow up. You know, if you're serious about...
That's a whole separate issue. We're talking about CAFE standards here.
What?
That's a whole separate issue. I mean,
if you're serious about the CO2, CAFE is not going to do a single thing.
Sure, it will. If you increase the efficiency of cars, than, you know, people driving essentially the same amount.
Why will they drive the same amount? They'll probably drive more because every mile, every gallon of gas gives them more miles.
Vast majority of people are not using their cars as constant pleasure vehicles. In fact, in America now, after 26 years of warfare on the middle class, most people are driving to their second and third job most of the time.
Yeah, but look, lots of people, first of all, look at the price of gas when they decide what type of car to buy. And secondly, in the midterm and long term, they look at the price of gas when they decide where to look for a new job, how long a commute they want, where their kids are going to go.
No, I agree with all that, but what you're saying is if you do it that way, it's going to take years, maybe a decade or more, for those high gas prices to work, to translate down to changes in auto manufacturers meeting the new demands of the marketplace.
Wait a second. High gas prices have had a pretty immediate effect ever since the post-Hurricane Katrina spikes, which is why the American car makers are in so much trouble. You've had huge shifts in new car buying patterns.
Right, and if we had put these CAFE standards in place, say, 2 years ago or 3 years ago, so that the car makers were already making fuel-efficient cars, more of them, then we wouldn't have Toyota being the, you know, basically the largest car manufacturer in the United States.
The CAFE currently is, say, 27.5 miles per gallon for passenger cars. Suppose 2 years ago it had been 35 miles per gallon. I don't think the automotive manufacturing picture would really have looked any different. I think the companies that are great at meeting consumer demand also end up generally being very good at meeting government demands as well.
But part of consumer demand is more efficient cars.
When gas prices are going up, you certainly, and that's one reason why I think the way consumers are reacting to today's gas prices and the perception that they're going to keep getting higher and higher is the way to go. Consumers are getting more fuel economy in a much more intelligent and much more individualized and flexible manner than any government program could ever produce.
So you're saying that we should just do absolutely nothing. You don't even want there to be CAFE standards.
I would get, CAFE is one program I'd get rid of in the blink of an eye.
And yet what,
But by the way, I've never met any defender of CAFE who admits that it kills anyone. Here you've got a program that the National Academy of Sciences funds.
Well, actually, you know, there is a dispute there, frankly, because there are suggestions that the larger cars are more likely to roll over and kill people in rollover accidents. So,
that's right. But when you look at the overall death rates, and this is from the Auto Insurance for Highway Safety, which is funded by the auto insurance industry, and that industry has a very keen interest in.
But you're not willing to acknowledge that increased emissions of fossil fuels from coming out of tailpipes of cars is diminishing lung capacity and shortening lifespan of people in big cities.
Well, we talked about CO2 here. That has
I'm talking about we're burning. We don't just emit CO2 out of tailpipes.
But we're burning
gasoline in these
all
things.
All the other stuff we emit is subject to very stringent emission standards, and that's the same regardless of the size.
So the most effective emission standard in the world is to make a car that's more efficient.
All right, well, the efficiency has to do one with CO2 emissions of miles per gallon. Emissions, particulate, is a totally different issue.
Okay, Sam Kasman, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you.
Bye. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
$20 billion gallons of gasoline by the year 2020 would be saved if we simply increased the CAFE standards by 4 to 5 miles per gallon. If we simply did away with the exclusion of SUVs and minivans from CAFE standards, we'd save 5 billion gallons of gasoline a year. Did you know that there's a Hummer loophole? CAFE standards also don't apply to vehicles that weigh over 8,500 pounds, like GM Hummers and Ford Excursions. The EPA doesn't even measure them. They don't even test the fuel economy on these vehicles. They're considered trucks. So there's a dual fuel loophole that says that if you make a vehicle that can use multiple fuels, then that doesn't count. There's the SUV loophole. There's all these loopholes that need to be closed, frankly, in my opinion. And 20 billion gallons of gasoline by 2020, I mean, that's what, 13 years from now? It seems like a lot of crude oil that we wouldn't have to beg Saudi Arabia for. Yeah. Color me paranoid, but I just don't think it's a good idea to be so dependent upon Saudi Arabia. Robert in Beaverton, Oregon. Hey, Robert.
Hey, Tom. It's good to hear from you, or good to talk to you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to reply to your guest there.
Yeah.
I thought that when he said that we should ignore the CAFE standards and work on population problems, it seems kind of like saying, well, if you have the flu, you shouldn't take medicine for that. You should try to live a healthier lifestyle. I mean, it seems that the two don't exclude each other.
Yeah, a better analogy, if you want to use a medical analogy, would be, you know, somebody who has cancer and having the physician say, well, yeah, you've got cancer and there's a bunch of therapies for that, but first let's talk about that flu you have right now.
Right.
And spend all our time focusing on that. Yeah, I don't disagree, and it concerns me. So anyhow, good point. Thank you very much, Robert. Donna in San Diego, California. Hey, Donna.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you?
Not too bad. I've been, in the last couple of debates, I've been following Ron Paul pretty closely.
Yes.
And I'm curious what your take was on him. He's a libertarian. That kind of scares me a little bit, but maybe that's what we need to, fix up the Republican Party.
Well, I always say libertarians are Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid, and Ron Paul, demonstrates that they are, in fact, Republicans. Ron Paul has been on this program a number of times over the last 5 years that we've been on the air, or we're in our fifth year on the air, four years plus. And I've always, he historically, when he has come on, we have debated issues. I mean, I'll bring him on things that we disagree on. We're trying to get a hold of his people right now about getting him on just to talk about the political process that he's experiencing from the Republican side. I'm really curious. It looks to me like the Republican Party is doing everything they can to marginalize him, and I think one of the reasons is because he's doing so well in the polls. I made this comment last night on Paul Azan's show on CNN. I said, if Ron Paul is the Dennis Kucinich of the Republican Party. He's the truth teller. He's the boy who said that the emperor has no clothes.
Yeah. What I hear him saying is like what we want, and we need a leader to be saying.
Yeah.
Telling the truth, not the rhetoric that Giuliani and all the rest of them are doing along the way. Yeah. And I was just curious, what your thought of. I said libertarians kind of scare me a little bit because they are a little bit. I'm not saying I don't believe in completely no government. I think it's a certain purpose, but I think it needs to be toned down a little bit. From what is to come.
Well, I think with regard to Ron Paul, in terms of whether or not he has any chances in the future, I think no. And the reason why is because the Republican Party machine doesn't like who he is and what he's saying and what he's doing. I mean, they just don't. They're not going to go down that road. They don't want a truth teller in their party, frankly. And what's going to be very interesting to watch over time here is whether they're successful in excluding him from future debates and future discussions. Ed in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Ed.
Hey, Tom. Listen, on this continuity of government thing, I had a couple points. One of them is that I thought it was the case that after 9/11 that continuity of government things were actually put in motion, and that's Cheney's undisclosed location has been running a parallel government this whole time. And the other thing is that I just wanted to mention that presidents aren't the only ones that can have contingency plans. And I think that we really need to talk about this thing a lot with everybody we know. And if they actually go public and say, okay, the Constitution is suspended, we need to have a plan, all of us, to just take to the streets and say no more work until the Constitution's restored.
Yeah, or more. I think that what we need to do right now is bring this to the attention of our elected officials and say, hey, did you know about this National Security Presidential Directive, and will you do something about it? I mean, Congress should be doing this, Ed. There should be a debate in Congress about what should be done. at the end of days, as it were, in case of a disaster here in the United States. And what should be done if, perhaps more importantly, given who's in the White House right now, what should be done if some relatively minor disaster, I mean minor on a global or even a national scale, it could be a major disaster locally, you know, a major city like a Katrina kind of thing. I mean, you could argue that that's a major disaster, but is that a major disaster worthy of taking down the Constitution? No. So what if that kind of a disaster, a big earthquake in California or something, causes Bush to step up and say, okay, I'm taking over now, I'm the decider. You know, what are we going to do? 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Coming up on 35. Tom Hartman here with you. John McEnroe on the line with us, the former world number one professional tennis player from the United States. John, welcome to Air America 2.0 and being an Air American.
Well, thank you. Also the world. You know, I hit number one in the world for 4 years, so.
Yeah. No, I said.
I thought I heard you say United States. I wanted to. Get my quick brownie point.
Oh yeah, for sure. No, my line was former world number one professional tennis player from the United States.
And
you are from the United States, right?
born in Wiesbaden in West Germany, but yes.
Oh really? Oh interesting.
Yeah, my father was in the Air Force. So.
Ah, okay. You're on the board of River Keepers and involved with helping the environment. I'm curious about your take on the role of environmentalism in this coming election. The extent to which you're seeing it. Or would want to see it as a primary issue in the primaries and as a primary issue in the general election.
Well, I'm a little concerned about how important it will be in the primaries, but I'm hopeful that it will be more important. And I get a good sense that in the general election it could sway the voters, hopefully, to picking perhaps a Democrat this time around. But, you know, I've been a big fan of Bobby Kennedy Jr.'s for many years, and he spearheads that organization, and I think he's a brilliant guy. As a matter of fact, I hope he runs for something soon.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've learned so much just, you know, hearing him talk at a lot of the events and fortunate enough to be friends with him. And I think just historically, the Hudson River is so important to us as Americans. Even strategically, way back when the Revolutionary War was going on, it was probably one of the most, if not the most important areas. And now moving forward in the present day with Indian Point so close to New York City and how much of an issue that has become and will continue to be, I think it's really important to talk about it more and more. And I think it's good. I've also go back a ways with Elliot Spitzer, who's now the governor. We played sports against each other in high school and, you know, it's something that he's talking about, and you're hearing at least the politicians publicly discussing it more. I mean, it's frustrating because one second you hear a ruling where they're going to review the whole Indian Point and they're going to take a closer look. The next second, someone down in Washington changes that ruling or somehow it goes away. The people that own it somehow pay. It seems like they're, you know, I'm coming from a ignorance, obviously, to a large degree, but it feels like people are being paid off to not discuss it. And it seems like for something just to make Indian Point safe, with the amount of money that I think is the company that owns it, the amount of money that these guys make, I don't think people realize the average person, they're making something in the neighborhood of $1 million a day. And it seems like the very least they could do for that type of profit is to make sure that some catastrophe doesn't happen there. So I'm proud to be a member of the Riverkeeper Board.
Yeah, and it's great work. I'm curious about your thoughts on Al Gore. He has a new book out, Assault on Reason. It's embargoed until now. It was just reviewed today in the New York Times, or perhaps you've seen An Inconvenient Truth. Would you think that he should be running for president?
I'd like to see it. You know, I was a bit of a cynic back in 2000. I was, you know, I called myself for many years an unregistered cynic. I was a kid at 17 who saw Jimmy Carter come along, and I thought he was great, and but I was a little bit too young to vote, and then I didn't really pay attention and didn't vote for a while. And I remember in 84 coming back from England and getting a Concord, which they still had the time, to make sure it was the day of the election that I could vote in. Hmm. In the 84 election, and the plane was detoured to Washington, D.C., and obviously I wasn't a district or area that I was registered to vote in. And I got to my friend's house. It was about 5 o'clock at night, 5:30, and Reagan had 543 electoral votes to Mondale's 3, and I said, God, the polls don't even close 8 or 9 o'clock. I just felt sort of... I really didn't feel that I was so disappointed with the fact that it didn't seem like my vote meant anything. But as I've gotten older and become a father, I've got 6 kids now, getting to know a guy like Mark Green over the course of the last 8 to 10 years, seeing what he's gone through politically and the difficulties he's had. And actually, I hate to admit this, but in 2000, feeling like I wanted to finally set a better example for my kids and start voting, feeling like my vote in a way didn't count, voting for Nader in 2000.
I voted for Nader in 2002, although I did, my wife and I split it. We lived in Vermont, and we knew that the state was going to go for Al Gore. And so, I wanted the Green Party to get their 5% so that they could be, you know, taken more seriously, because they're doing great work on a local level. But if I had thought that the election was going to be close in Vermont, I there's no doubt I would have voted for Al Gore. But you know, I think a lot of us flipped that coin, and a lot of us in 2004 didn't make the same mistake.
Exactly. I didn't as well. But yeah, at the same time, I was somewhat disappointed in Gore in 2000 that he didn't fight for it longer.
Well, he fought it all the way to the Supreme Court. It was really John Kerry who walked away from it.
That's true. What I would have done if I was Gore is I would have really made more of an effort to cut a deal with Nader before the actual election took place.
Yeah, I'm not sure that Nader was cut a dealable.
Well, that may be true.
He's a pretty black and white guy. But
as far as Gore running now, the answer to me would be yes. I mean, I think there's some pretty good candidates.
Are there any other candidates that are at the top of your list?
You know, one thing, Tom, that I'm lucky is that because of the position and just as someone who's somewhat known in the sports world, I get a good opportunity to go to a lot of these fundraisers or to meet, you know, potential candidates, whether it's Hillary Clinton or John Edwards or Obama was on my talk show when I had a talk show during the Democratic convention in 2004. And so I felt like, I see some good candidates. I mean, I don't know a guy like Bill Richardson, but he seems like a pretty impressive guy.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me like we've got a pretty good field out there. But having said that, because of all this momentum that Gore's had through Inconvenient Truth and, his work in the environment and how critical to me as a father of 6 kids that's become and will become even more so in the future. There's a part of me that I feel like he won in 2000 anyway, that he should run again. But, I mean, that's obviously his personal decision.
We're talking with John McEnroe, the tennis legend, number one world professional tennis player. And, John, you're, I mean, deep inside the world of sports. And I've always been very much an outsider to the world of sports. I'm wondering to what extent there's this kind of stereotype of people who are into sports as being disconnected from politics, and I know that that stereotype to a large extent is not true, but I'm wondering what you're seeing among both professionals within the sports world and commentators and, you know, just that whole spectrum, and fans in the sports world. Are they becoming more politicized? Are they becoming more politically aware? Where is that all at right now?
Well, I think it's becoming more politically aware, but I think we're far behind where we should be. And part of that is because a lot of athletes have success at an extremely young age, and they're not mature enough or, quite honestly, knowledgeable enough of world affairs or even probably local ones to really feel like they should step into the middle of things, and in a lot of cases are taken advantage of. But I think because times seem to be so crazy now that it's more important than ever. Now, I've been around sports for 30 years, and I know when I was 18 years old, if I was going to make a, have a conversation and talk about politics, or someone asked me to do that, I would have said they were crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And even now, I feel like a bit of an outsider looking in, but I've been fortunate enough to be around some really brilliant people, met the politicians, and actually have thought about, you know, some of my crazier moments, you know, what would it be like if I went into some type of public service? And
mm-hmm.
the more that I learn about it, the farther away I think that I want to be from it, and the less that I believe will actually happen, probably from a selfish reason, is the intrusions on your life and what these people have to give up.
Yeah, it'd be a very tough thing running for any
and it's all
like,
so you know, I feel like I, in a way, I have the best of both worlds. I've learned from my own experiences the last 30 years or so. I feel like I've grown up to a degree. But, you know, to me, hobby is the wrong word, but I really enjoy, you know, listening about the political process and what's going on. I don't feel like an expert by any means.
How do those of us who are into politics reach out to people who are into sports, who view the things as mutually exclusive?
Well, one of the things I just mentioned is, you know, as a very small thing, but making it easier to register to vote. If, you know, I think I find that to be really a turnoff. And I think that I go so far as to say that making it, and maybe this is wrong, but requiring people to vote.
Well, in Australia, for example, it's a $25 fine if you don't vote. And I think it goes up over time with each election that you don't vote in. And so they get something like 98% compliance.
I think that's a good way to approach it. And maybe the money, if you decide not to do it, goes to some, you know, environmental or cause or,
yeah,
you know,
well, it goes into the government, you know, the bottom line for the government, which is
that's a good thing.
In Australia, in Australia, that helps pay for the national health care system, for example, and infrastructure and education. So.
I think there's a definite argument for that. But to me, it's like, I feel like I know John Kerry very well, just through playing, I don't know him well, it's the wrong thing to say, but I've met him on a number of occasions. And, you know, John Kerry's obviously a brilliant guy, but there was part of it where you feel like he's a harder person to approach. And I think in some ways, you know, people that don't feel like they're that knowledgeable about it just want to feel like they can approach these people without feeling like they're idiots.
Make it more accessible. John McEnroe, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Great talking with you. John McEnroe, the former world number one professional tennis player, and Air American, here on our relaunch of Air America 2.0. Tom Hartman broadcasting live from WWRL in New York City.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Oh, what a plan. How about some liberty? Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from WWRL in New York City, AM 1600. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us. Hey, Ellen.
Well, how are you? There's a lot going on, and it's mainly around the immigration bill.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to spend the rest of the week on amendments. And Senator Dorgan today was pretty impassioned. He wants to eliminate what's in the bill by having 400,000 a year guest workers. He said that it's fiction, that Americans are not willing to do these jobs. Jeff Bingham of New Mexico wants to reduce it to 200,000 guest workers. And the other thing that's been happening is the Capitol switchboard has been going completely nuts with people calling about this bill.
Yeah. It's and in fact, in today's, I think it was the Wall Street Journal, there was an article suggesting, or no, it, maybe it was the Financial Times of London. I read them both this morning. And in any case, there was an article suggesting that the business community in America may be what kills this bill.
Well, it would not be surprising, but it's also perhaps going to be just Joe and Susie Citizen when people go into their districts next week.
Right, but Joe and Susie Citizen are not the ones who are writing the million-dollar checks to the members of Congress and
well, I understand, but when people go home to their districts or to their states, they get peppered to death at their various town hall meetings, it's not going to be pretty in the next week, I don't think.
Yeah.
Also, today, Senator, something we've been talking about, Senator Kerry has actually held a press conference this morning at the Senate talking about this issue of how much not giving the military in terms of an increase from 3.0 to 3.5%, and also this $40 a month monthly benefit for surviving spouses and military families. And as you know, the Office of Management and Budget said that the House moves to increase this pay was unnecessary. Well, Kerry seized the opportunity this morning and really went quite bananas about it. I mean, as you noted, you're talking about $6 a week in some cases.
Right. Yeah, and John Kerry has always been a good defender of veterans' rights. Ellen, I'm curious if you're familiar with and if there's any discussion at all among the press corps. It seems I haven't seen this in any mainstream media. Only Matthew Rothschild writing about it over in the Progressive. So far, I think it's starting to creep out. But on May 9th, George Bush signed and the White House posted at whitehouse.gov a news release and the transcript of a National Security Presidential Directive, NSPD 51, which says that in the event of a disaster, and they define disaster so broadly that it could happen anywhere in the United States. In other words, this does not have to be a disaster that disrupts the Congress, for example, where there are already contingency plans for that kind of thing. But this is like, in the event of another Katrina or in the event of an earthquake in California, then the president can declare that a catastrophic emergency and then, quote, then what happens is that our form of government changes to become what's called an enduring constitutional government, or ECG. And reading from the directive, it says, enduring constitutional government, or ECG, means a cooperative effort among the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of the federal government coordinated by the president. In other words, if there's a disaster,
right,
and the president decides, he becomes emperor.
Originally, this kind of situation was meant in the nuclear bunker situation,
right,
where, you had 20 people left, or in the situation where one person is left out of the Capitol when the president gets his state of the
right, union. And we've had contingencies for that since the 1950s.
Exactly. So this is thought to be a continuation with, of course, the president seizing broad powers, as we know he has done. It is going to take a little while to filter down to the Senate and House. As you know, they're usually the last to deal with this kind of thing. But my guess is that this will be taken up.
Yeah, we're the last to know.
But these people are very slow movers. It has to be a push from radio shows like yours, Tom, before people pay attention.
Yeah, so we need to be telling our listeners to call your elected members
every day and putting information on the web if it's going to make a darn bit of difference.
Yeah, well, we're certainly talking about it here, and we'll continue to. Amazing. And Ellen, also the L.A. Times, front page story in yesterday's L.A. Times, saying that senior U.S. officials are starting to back away from Nouri al-Maliki, the prime minister of
Iraq. The president has again said that he is supporting al-Maliki. When this came up, he said he supported al-Maliki.
Did he say he's doing a heck of a job?
I'm sorry?
Did he say he's doing a heck of a job?
It's a heck of a job Browning kind of situation.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Because there's talk about, now with what's going on in Lebanon, some of the back channel talk that I'm hearing is that a scenario that could play out is that Bush could say, okay, the Lebanese, what's going on in Lebanon, even though it doesn't appear to have anything to do with Hezbollah, could say that it does. And Hezbollah is supported by Iran. And therefore, Iran is causing this problem in Lebanon. And therefore, now we have a justification to attack Iran. And Nouri al-Maliki, is not up for that. And let's replace him and let's take out Iran. And that's the plan B for the plan A of failing of the ongoing occupation of Iraq.
They're definitely not admitting that, but that would not be out of character in any way, shape, or form. But Bush has gone on record again saying that he supports the al-Maliki government. Let me just do one last little thing here. House Judiciary Committee is prepared to use subpoenas against Karl Rove. They again issued an appeal for a voluntary
habeas. This is John Conyers. Has he put a deadline on it?
I didn't see the paper, I have to confess, so I don't know, but I think it's more of a threat.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. I mean, the House Judiciary Committee is typically where bills of impeachment, well, it is where bills of impeachment have to originate. Interesting, very interesting. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thanks. You too. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, talkradionews.com, their website. Coming up next, Mark Green, the president of Air America Radio, interviewing Hillary Clinton. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio. Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Welcome to the Democracy Zone.
And welcome back to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from WWRL 1600, our affiliate in New York City, from beautiful downtown Manhattan. And as part of the launch, the relaunch of Air America, Air America 2.0, a variety of the talent and people who work at Air America have been interviewing a number of celebrities and people involved in the world of politics, and one of them, Mark Green, the president of Air America. And he had a conversation earlier, I believe it was yesterday afternoon, with Hillary Clinton. Here it is.
This is Mark Green, president of Air America Radio. We are extremely grateful to be joined by Senator Hillary Clinton of New York. Senator, thank you for coming on and being, in a sense, Air American during our relaunch of Air America 2.0.
Well, I am thrilled that you are relaunching, and I'm going to do everything I can, Mark, to make sure that the country gets to know you and this great lineup of talent that you've got on Air America 2.0.
Thank you. I'd like to reciprocate, but in as much as I'm running a media company, I am personally neutral presidentially, but I don't know how many of our listeners will be voting for the Republican or independent nominee. Senator, on the issues, looking backward, what lessons did you learn first from the failure of comprehensive health care reform in the early 90s under President Bill Clinton, and then from your vote authorizing the Iraq War in late 2002?
Well, look, I think there's so many lessons. With respect to health care, I've talked about this often in the last number of years. One thing I learned is that even if you've got a plan which would lower costs and improve quality and cover every American, you have to do a really effective job of communicating that to the people of our country and of withstanding the onslaught from the forces that are going to be disadvantaged financially, and obviously that's primarily the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies. We had a plan that I think would have really helped our country and taken us to where we need to go, but we then had to face $300 million of advertising that really distorted the plan and distorted the process. You know, I'm sure you and your listeners have heard about how, you know, we didn't talk to anybody and we had this closed process. Well, I don't know how you run a closed process when you have more than 1,000 people involved.
Let me interrupt. Should a Democrat become president in 2009, those forces, those $300 million plus, will still be there. So what would be different in 2009 than in 1994?
Well, I think several things. Number one, the country has moved much toward the idea that we've got to decrease costs, improve quality, and cover everybody. Back in 93 and 94, a lot of people thought that, you know, Bill and I were doing this to help people who didn't have insurance, but if they already had insurance, they didn't think that was something that would affect them. Now everybody knows that we have to improve the system. Secondly, we have a lot of strange bedfellows. We've got large companies like Walmart standing up there with large unions like SEIU and all saying the same thing. You know, we've got to get to universal health care coverage. So there's a greater awareness on the part of major institutional forces that they need to get in line and help deal with what we have to do. And finally, you know, I think that when Bill and I took this on, when he was president, he had a lot of important issues on his plate, as you recall, like trying to get us out of a huge deficit hole, which we're back into, unfortunately. He took on the NRA. And it is important that, you know, we really get the Congress on board and have a place at the table mm-hmm. from the very beginning so that we can work together. Nothing passes the Senate unless you can overcome the 60-vote filibuster. So it may not be the plan that you and I would want if we could start from scratch, but it sure will be a plan that we can, you know, try to get bipartisan support for and get the country behind.
Senator, let me reframe the second part of the question on the Iraqi war. How is your resolution, your proposed resolution with Senator Byrd, an effective way to make President Bush reverse course now in Iraq, which is another way of saying, what did you learn from your vote in late 2002 authorizing the initial invasion?
Well, you know, Mark, back in 2002, I joined with Senator Byrd to limit the president's authority to 1 year. I was, you know, skeptical but willing to give the president the benefit of the doubt that he would do what he said and what his government said, which was to put inspectors back in who'd been kicked out in 98 and try to find out once and for all what kind of, you know, weapons of mass destruction Saddam still had, and frankly, to contain Saddam at a time when, you know, there was a legitimate concern that he would want to try to flex his muscles in some dangerous and threatening way because he wouldn't want Osama bin Laden to be viewed as the, you know, the leader in the Islamic world. Well, obviously, this president did not keep his word and did not intend to. We now know from a lot of the information that has come out since. And as I've said, you know, if I'd known then what I know now, I never would have given the president authority because he has unfortunately and regrettably misused that authority. But what Senator Byrd and I are trying to do is to, you know, force a debate on the fact that the authorization, which we wanted to limit to a year, has now been used for 5 years as of October 11th, 2007. If there is any remaining purpose for American involvement in Iraq, it is certainly not what was originally sold to the American public. And the president should have to come to the Congress and the people and explain exactly what he's trying to do and ask for the authority to do it. Because I don't think he does have authority to participate with our young men and women in a sectarian civil war. So that's what Senator Byrd and I are trying to achieve by putting that out there.
Senator Clinton, I want to move to a domestic issue that's not involving the war, but a corporate consumer war at home. The New York Times had a front page article a couple days ago that Michael Baruti, a well-known corporate lobbyist in Washington for the National Association of Manufacturers, was given a $150,000 severance payment from the NAM just as he's leaving to become the appointed chair of the Consumer Product Safety Commission by President Bush. And that enforces the safety laws against the exact kind of companies that he lobbied for and that gave him money. Admission, Senator, I ran the Clinton-Gore CPSC, Consumer Product Safety Commission, transition team in 92, and I regard this money and appointment as sort of a delayed bribe. What's your view of this nomination, since you'll have to vote on it?
Well, I'm very concerned about this nomination, and a number of my colleagues are. They have placed holds on his nomination. Our problem is that this president, as we know, isn't reluctant at all to appoint people that the Congress would never confirm to important positions as recess appointments. And what we're trying to do is send a very clear signal that that would be unacceptable, and we are going to do what we can to get to the bottom of the severance pay and his positions on a number of issues and, you know, express strongly our opposition to his becoming the head of this important agency.
If he was up for a vote today, and if he's voted down, of course, he can do a recess appointment like he did with Bolton, for example,
right,
to the UN. If Michael Baruti kept $150,000, would you say now whether you could vote for him or oppose him?
Well, I'm leaning against his appointment, but it's not just about the severance pay. It's about, you know, putting the, you know, the fox in the chicken coop. I mean, we need somebody who actually cares about consumers' rights and protecting consumers. You know, as you have been a leader on this for so many years, Mark, and I don't think that this is the kind of candidate for this important position that really fulfills the mandate of protecting consumers.
If I could go back to Iraq now that I think of it, I watched you in the MSNBC debate, and all of you had to respond what you would do if America were simultaneously attacked twice. Let me ask a slightly different hypothetical. What if, as president, your Department of Defense proposed to you a preemptive attack, like Bush did in Iraq, on a nation supposedly harboring terrorists or 3 years away from issuing, from having enough fissionable material for a nuclear device? Given the experience we've gone through with Iraq, what kind of questions would you as president be privately asking your Defense Department, State Department, Joint Chiefs?
You know, Mark, that is such a serious issue, I can't possibly answer it in, you know, the time we have. But rest assured that I consider our, you know, use of military force a last resort, not a first resort. During the debate on the authorization back in 02, I explicitly said this was not a vote for preemption, which I think has proven to be very unfortunate and is not a doctrine that the United States should embrace. Our intelligence has clearly not been as effective as we need it, and the misuse of intelligence has been a real problem in this administration. So there's a range of issues and concerns that I would be expressing, and I think it's important that our next president, which I obviously am hoping is me, exercise the kind of prudent, reasonable, careful assessment that clearly was disregarded, even held in contempt by the current president.
We'll be back with more of Mark Green and Hillary Clinton right here on the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, 17 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Program, and now the second half, the last half of Mark Green's interview, president of Air America, with Hillary Clinton.
The Senator, we've spoken previously about how our, not our Iraqi, but our American democracy has withered in the past 6 years at least on voting rights, campaign finance, secrecy. How optimistic are you that some or all of your Count Every Vote Act can be enacted?
Well, we're making progress. You know, when the Democrats took over the Congress, my friend and colleague, Senator Dianne Feinstein, became the chair of the Rules Committee, which gave us a real fighting chance to do electoral reform right. She's taken a lot of my ideas from the Count Every Vote Act and will be introducing a comprehensive approach to what we need to do on electoral reform. So I am actually optimistic. I think also the Attorney General firing of U.S. attorneys because they wouldn't, you know, go on wild goose chases and persecute Democrats over alleged voting irregularities gives us an even stronger case that there has been, you know, such a collapse in the integrity of our electoral system, you know, driven principally by Republicans seeking partisan advantage, that I think we're going to have a very strong case to make to try to repair the electoral system and restore confidence in it.
Well, if President Bush just appointed a war czar, would you as president appoint a law czar, since we're a little lacking there?
Well, actually, Mark, I will appoint people who can do the job. The Attorney General is supposed to be the law czar. You know? Instead, we had someone who had been the president's personal attorney who apparently didn't understand that that job was over when he became Attorney General. And, you know, I've called on him to resign, and I'm going to be joining with the no-confidence vote against him that we're going to be presenting to the Congress.
Let me conclude with a couple of questions about the presidential races itself and from the New York perspective. Rudy Giuliani from our home state, of course, is running on the other side. And you rarely comment on the Republican primary race. But Mayor Giuliani in the last debate at Fox News, suddenly unasked, quoted you saying, oh, look at that quote. Hillary Clinton is hostile to. But it wasn't your quote. It was someone else's quote. Has Giuliani engaged in this kind of attack on you before? And actually, you're a pro at this. How do you respond to what you regard as false attributions of comments to you?
Well, we really are focusing on the Democratic primary and what I have to do to win, as you know so well because of your own experience and close observation of politics in New York. I actually ran against him for a while back in 99 and 2000.
Right.
It's too early to predict a subway series in the presidential competition, but there'll be a time and a place for everything.
Well, let me talk about that because I am in, as a New Yorker, I am in anticipatory shock that three New Yorkers could plausibly be the Democratic, Republican, and independent presidential candidates in 08. And we haven't had a president since FDR. And there are 49 other states, I read. Senator, have you spoken with Mayor Bloomberg about his prospects or joked with him? And what are you three people, what is in the drinking water in New York that is leading to this cluster of ambition?
Well, Mark, it just may be pent-up frustration that, New York hasn't had a president in a while. And I think it's exciting. But, again, I'm staying focused on what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And I have no, no control and I have no vote in what anybody else does.
Well, but you're focused on apparently your campaign song. I mean, let's
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Do you have a suggestion?
Well, I will not recommend Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow.
Well, that was actually a perfect song in 92, and we're looking for the perfect song for 2008.
I'm not going to get in trouble. Let me end with an Air America question, if I could. I get asked this all the time, and I was asked it last night by Neil Cavuto on the so-called Fox News. I'd love to hear your view. Question, why is right-wing radio financially done better, more popular, arguably, in the past than progressive talk radio?
Well, I think that's changing, but certainly it had a lot of financial support. It was much more incendiary and personally abusive to people in public life, which was like driving by an accident. Everybody felt they had to watch. Well, in this case, everybody felt they had to tune in and listen, and it played to a lot of the worst common denominator attitudes that some people in our country hold. And also I would say that a lot of the people on talk radio came out of radio. They
Right.
were not people who were doing it for the first time. They knew how to be entertaining. They knew how to keep an audience. They had worked on it for a number of years. But we're catching up, and I think that what you're doing really is important. If we're going to have a vigorous debate in our country about all the issues we're confronting, we sure can't have, one side dominating. We've got to be able to, hear and trade views and have a vigorous, dialogue. And I think that's what Air America is really aiming to fulfill.
Well, we appreciate that observation, but we mostly, Senator Clinton, appreciate your time and thoughtfulness for joining us today.
It is a pleasure, Mark, and I really wish you and your whole team well.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
That was Mark Green, President of Air America Radio, interviewing Hillary Clinton. We'll be back with your calls right after this on the Air America program.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
I believe in the magic of democracy. I believe in the magic of the will of the people. I believe in the magic of this country and the ideals on which it was founded. And I believe in the magic of all of us getting out there and getting involved and bringing democracy back to the United States of America. This extraordinary, constitutionally limited, representative democratic republic. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from our New York City affiliate, WWRL 1600 AM. At 35 minutes past the hour, our number 866-303-2270. And Michael in Antioch, California. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today?
Tom, how you doing? I'd like to talk about Ron Paul, as you talked about him earlier.
Sure.
I wrote an article for Op-Ed News. It was called The Other Ron Paul, and I've taken quite a beating on it. There's been a lot of talk and a lot of there have been a lot of articles at Op-Ed News about Ron Paul, and I just want to confirm what you've said about Ron is that if a vote for Ron Paul is not a vote for progressive. And it's getting to be the there's sort of an environment out there that because he's a maverick on the war, that he is a progressive, but he's very far from it. As a matter of fact, he would privatize probably as much as the Bush administration would.
Oh, he would privatize everything in the government except for the Army.
That's right.
That's about it. He no more regulatory agencies. Period. No more Food and Drug Administration. These are conversations that he and I have had. I don't recall the specific agencies that we talked about, but I can tell you philosophically, and when he ran for president as a libertarian, philosophically, it was like, the government has no business in these things. These should all be left up to the private marketplace. If people die, other people will figure out that they shouldn't buy from that company. And if that company changes names every 2 weeks, people will figure out how to tell each other that company is, you know the logic chain that these guys use.
Right.
We have them on the program all the time, and they try and put it out.
Right.
Ron Paul is a libertarian, and libertarianism is the most extreme form of conservatism.
That's right. I'd also like to compare him in a way to Dennis Kucinich, too, in the Democratic Party. You said the Republican machine might try to get keep Ron Paul out of the debates.
Yeah.
And I know Kucinich speaks sort of against the Democratic machine, if you will. And
well,
I'm hoping that they
don't
do the same thing with Representative Kucinich.
Yeah, I agree. And Dennis, in many ways, is a thorn in the side of the Democratic machine. And Ron Paul is a thorn in the side of the Republican machine. Dennis being arguably the most progressive of the Democratic candidates, and Ron Paul being the most conservative of the Republican candidates. And the praise, to the extent that I praise Ron Paul, that I have for him, is that he's one of the few conservatives in Congress who is absolutely, totally upfront and honest about his perspectives. And I have, as you know, from the people that I have as guests on this program that I argue and debate with, I actually have a lot of respect for somebody who will tell you the truth about what they think and what they feel. And I have very little respect for the occasional weasel who comes on and tries to debate with me, and we can all figure out that they have a hidden agenda. And Ron Paul, as far as I can tell, doesn't have any hidden agendas. It's all hanging out there, which is why the Republicans are terrified of him. But, good point, Michael, and I appreciate the call. Thank you very much. Kyle in San Rafael, California. Hey, Kyle.
Hi. I must say I'd vote for Ron Paul before I'd vote for Hillary Clinton. And it's just a knee-jerk reaction. I am attacking her from the left and not from the right. I get very angry when the right-wingers attack her, which is an interesting paradox. But I'm calling about the National Security Presidential Directive.
Yes.
And I haven't been this mad since they suspended habeas corpus.
Yeah, this is worse. This is suspending everything.
This is the end.
If I'm reading it right. I mean, it may be that I'm missing something here, but I don't think so.
I don't think so.
You can go online and you can read it. It's right over at whitehouse.gov. It's the National Security Presidential Directive, NSPD 51. It's very easy to Google, very easy to find, and it's right, it's the official White House, and it says Enduring Constitutional Government, or ECG. See, they've given a new acronym to USA. It's no longer USA, it's now ECG.
Yeah.
Or ECG means a cooperative effort among the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of the federal government coordinated by the president.
Truthout has a very good piece on this. It's mostly taken from the progressives, but it does have some interesting links. Daily Kos, of course, were the first people to go wide with it, and I missed it. So I only discovered this last night on some of the radio here in the San Francisco Bay Area. But the Daily Kos has an interesting link that takes you back to Ron Paul. And Ron Paul has a fascinating analysis of this thing, which, among other things, points out that if there is a national emergency and members of Congress are killed, that the president would then, under this new continuity of government commission program, he would then be allowed to appoint members of Congress.
Right. Right. A brand new job for Brownie.
Pardon?
A brand new job for Brownie. Brownie, that's now the congressman from Maryland.
So here you go. With this is a call, a nationwide call to action. We have got to get on the phone and make sure that every representative that we can call today, this week, this month, knows that the American public are slow to awake, but aren't going to stand for this kind of madness.
Yeah.
This is the end of democracy.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, Kyle. I totally agree. I'm not in my normal studio, and I don't have my little post-it note with the phone numbers for Congress, but from memory, my recollection is it's 202-225-3121. Somebody call in and correct me if I'm wrong, or let me know in the chat room if I'm wrong. In fact, I'm sure somebody in the chat room has it right at the tip of their tongue, and they'll give it to us, and I'll put it out again and make sure that it's right. Stefano in San Diego, California. Hey, Stefano.
Hi, sir. I was wondering if you could elucidate, literally bring out to light something that frightened me a bit about the national directive.
Yeah.
It didn't sound like this was necessarily a U.S.-based catastrophe. It could happen anywhere in the world, namely, I don't know, Iraq.
Well, here's the exact language.
Okay.
Catastrophic emergency means any incident, regardless of location, that results in extraordinary levels of mass casualties, damage, or disruption severely affecting the U.S. population, infrastructure, environment, economy, or government functions. Now, the way I read that is that if something happened in Mexico or Canada that the president decided severely affected the U.S. population, or for that matter, if it happened in the Middle East, you know, or the Far East. I mean, if Pakistan decided to drop a bomb on India and George Bush says, this is going to affect the U.S., or this is going to affect our environment because fallout's coming, then he could declare a catastrophic emergency. I mean, the problem is this is so damn vague.
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Thank you, Stefano, for the call. I mean, this is, positively concerning. Charlie in Brooklyn, New York. Oh, and by the way, in the chat room, it's 202-225-3121. And you can ask. Each one of us has one member of the House of Representatives and two senators. Give me your zip code. Tell them what state you're from, and they will tell you who those persons are. If you're not sure, call 202-225-3121. Charlie in Brooklyn. Hey, Charlie.
I want to thank you. This has been a really informative show. It's like a lefty's dream, you know, to hear all these interviews. And you're the town crier. The National Security Directives, I hadn't heard about that. And it's, unfortunately, while it's dismaying, it's not surprising because it's all of a piece with what they're doing, with the lawlessness that pervades this administration, the unlimited power they seek. The Frontline TV documentary last week about wiretapping, you hear John Yoo presenting their view of what the presidential powers are. They're virtually unlimited. And
I heard him speak at the CPAC convention, and it gave me chill. And he debated, he was debating one of the conservative members of Congress, who was one of the leaders of the House impeachment thing, Bob Barr, Congressman Bob Barr from Georgia, and who I know. I mean, I don't know well, but I know in passing. I have a lot of respect for Bob Barr, more now than I did back then. But he debated Bob Barr, and Bob Barr was standing up for the Constitution, and John Yoo was going, no, we need to give more and more of these powers to the president. And the crowd, I mean, there's like 3,000 people. This is the big conservative annual gathering of the year, and the crowd is entirely with you, and they're booing Bob Barr, the Republican, conservative Republican, a very conservative Republican, for saying that the Constitution should be defended rather than the president.
It's amazing. The perversion of the Fourth Amendment, the things that they said at the debate last week with Romney saying he wants to double Gitmo and Giuliani.
Yeah, it's the same thing.
They pander to this terrorist, we'll protect you, don't think, don't question. But what's really, I think we need to focus on, besides this NSA thing, which eventually they'll get around to investigating, is the Monica Goodling appearance tomorrow. Yeah. The way that they've politicize the Department of Justice. On the one hand, they proclaim how patriotic they are, and they have to protect us, and we can spare no. We have to give up all our civil liberties to be protected from the terrorists.
Like, yeah, this is the ultimate nanny state, by
right,
the way,
very,
to use
very
their
afraid.
Frame.
On the other hand, you look at their crass partisan politicization. They're just trying to look at who Goodling is. How did she get to the top of the Justice Department? Look at Gonzo with that story from Comey. It's frightening, the criminality that's rampant there.
Yeah. And what disturbs me about it the most is that the mainstream media and even some of our friends on the left characterize it as incompetence.
Exactly.
It is not incompetence. This is absolutely intentional. From Katrina on down, this is all intentional.
On this week with Stephanopoulos, Christina VandenHeuvel of The Nation was there, and Fareed Zakaria of Newsweek was just again saying, oh, it's just some incompetence. And she nailed him on. She said, no, it's obduracy and lawlessness.
Yes.
They can't keep writing it off as incompetence.
Yes, absolutely. Well said, Charlie. Thanks a lot for the call. And I would say it even goes beyond obduracy and lawlessness. I would say this is how they think a government should be run. If you don't believe in government and you're given a government agency, what are you going to do? You're going to milk it for everything you can get out of it and use it for wealth and power. 45 minutes past the hour. More of your calls right after this.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Do my friends. By the way, in the chat room, AJ in the chat room says, here's a toll-free number for Capitol Hill. These things come and go, so here's one that apparently is working right now. 1-877-851-6437. If you want to call your member of Congress toll-free, 877-851-6437. And I'll repeat that again in just a moment. Mark in Maine, welcome to the program. Hey, Mark.
Hey, how are you?
I'm great, but what's up?
I'm just so enervated by this whole debate. It's not honest.
Which debate are you talking about?
Well, the fact of pulling the troops out and the Democrats not standing up to...
Oh, the funding bill.
Yes, I'm sorry. I wasn't clear.
Yeah.
My point is this. We have appropriated in the last spending bill, the one before, $550 million to build Embassy Baghdad on 104 acres, 21 buildings. Do you ever hear anyone on the floor talking about this? And I ask this question because if I made any expense like that in my life, I certainly would want to protect it. I don't want the troops over there, but I don't think the debate is honest. They all know that if they pull the troops out, that is going to be beaten like a piñata. And just like in Iran, they'll attack it, and they need to protect it. And that is not being discussed. We're a big adults. We're adults. We can handle the truth. So why don't they say, American people, this is why we're not pulling the troops out. We made this huge investment, and what do you expect us to do? We were fooled into it, but here we are. Am I wrong?
I don't know, Mark. I really don't know. And I think if you were to talk to a dozen different Democrats, you'd probably get a dozen different answers. I don't think the fact that we have this huge embassy project going on is the, you know, any kind of major motivator I just don't know. I it concerns me, frankly.
Can I say one more thing?
I'm
just wondering, it's a waste of money, it seems like to me, though.
Well, time will tell. A lot is going to depend on how the Iraqi government shakes out and how badly the Middle East goes down. I mean, what we were seeing in Lebanon and all these kinds of things. I mean, there are a lot of reasons to be very concerned about what's going on in the Middle East. And if we could play a role there as a stabilizer, this may be a very good thing. My concern is that I don't think it's possible for us to play a role there as a stabilizer, particularly after what George Bush has done. I think our role in the Middle East is going to be largely or perhaps even purely inflammatory. But time will tell. I just don't know. But to your point about, you know, being disappointed about the Democrats not standing up on the funding bill, I think that that's a good one. And again, it illustrates the point that I keep making on this program, and it really is one of the central, you know, core values, beliefs that I hold about the importance of participation in democracy in the United States. It goes back to, for example, you know, Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton is not the person who would be my first choice for president right now. I have some vague preferences with regard to the primaries. She wouldn't be at the top of the list. But if she were the nominee for the Democratic Party right at this moment versus any of the Republicans on the Republican side, I would vote for her, and I would campaign for her to the extent that I felt comfortable doing that. And here's why. Not because I agree with her on all the issues, but because I believe that if enough of us get active in the Democratic Party, if enough of us help work together inside the Democratic Party, and I'm talking about even people who consider themselves Greens and progressives, as in the Progressive Party in Vermont and things like that, it is possible to participate in both. You can be both, active with the Green Party and the Democratic Party. If enough of us are there, if the parade gets big enough, then Hillary or whoever's at the head of the parade will say, okay, this is the direction we're going. And that's what we've been seeing for the last 4 months in Congress. And the fact that the Democrats seem to be backing away right now from George Bush trying to call their bluff simply demonstrates to me that not enough of us are speaking out to them. And I think that this congressional recess is frankly going to help them get their backbone back. And we're going to see more Republicans at the same time coming forward and saying, no, this isn't going to fly, because they're going back to the districts and they're hearing from people there as well. But the core thing is, you know, show up. If your member of Congress is doing a town hall meeting, whatever, show up, call them, give them a call and let them know what you think. Gene in Napa, California. Hey, Gene.
Tom, thank you for covering these presidential directives 51 and 20. I can't help but challenge the intent behind them. I feel no reassurance that Chertoff being given more power is when he had clear disregard for the people's welfare after Katrina.
Right, and I'm wondering if this is what Rumsfeld was doing, sitting in that office with 35 people in the Pentagon for the last 3 months or however long it's been since he left.
You know, if Bush uses the coming hurricane season to implement these new powers, the irony is Bush will grab total power because of what he said was not real, global warming.
What do you mean?
Well, that's why we're having these terrible hurricanes, is global warming. The Earth trying to cool itself.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just awful. And then...
So there's a certain irony there, but, yeah.
Yeah, and then this cooperative effort that you quoted, does that mean that anybody who disagrees is not cooperative and so punishable? It's frightening.
You mean in the presidential directive?
Yes.
Yeah, as far as my read of this, and again, I'm not a lawyer and I'm not the ultimate expert on this, but I've been reading an awful lot of expert opinion on the internet, and again, the internet isn't always the most reliable source either. But it's time for us to have a national conversation about this. I mean, there's this entire commission out there that is looking into doing this kind of thing, and to have George Bush just kind of going around it. In fact, you can see it at continuityofgovernment.org. I mean, there's this commission, and this is not that. This is George Bush saying, "I Claudius." It's just too totally weird. So yes, we've launched Air America 2.0, and thanks so much for being with us. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag. You're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.